Alrighty, righty. Hello, hello. More fine questions from the listeners on X, the readers on X, x.com/Stefan Molyneux. What's your broader view of the history of European colonization? Was it good for the nations who were colonized? Was it good for the European nations themselves? Well, there's a shortcut to knowing not just what I accept or believe, but what is rational and moral to accept or believe, which is, does the activity in question require the violation of property rights, the initiation of force, the non-aggression principle? So, consequentialism, the broad patterns of success or failures. I've got whole videos on colonization and so on, colonial behaviors, fdpodcast.com. Just do a search for imperialism, colonialism, and so on. I got whole videos on that. So the complex sort of pluses and minuses, I mean, they're interesting, they're fun to play around with. But let's just look at what is colonialism. Colonialism is the government taking over other countries in a color the world in the colors of your flag game with all of the other powers. So how does colonialism work in fact and in practice? Well, colonialism works in fact and in practice when the government initiates the use of force against its own citizens to extract from them the resources to go and rule India or Ghana or wherever, right? I mean, that's how it works. So when you say, was it good for the nations who were colonized? Was it good for the European nations themselves? What do you mean by good? So in England, for instance, the domestic population was both kidnapped and forced into violent indentured servitude in, say, the Royal Navy or other aspects of military force, and the working class population was pillaged and robbed at gunpoint, sword point, knife point, whatever you want to call it, in order to pay for all of these things. So that's all you need to know. It's pretty easy to figure out. So all you need to know is that people calling themselves the government initiated the use of force against other people they referred to as taxpayers or citizens in order to fund and fuel their evil and psychotic need to invade and conquer other countries. And so it's wrong, it's bad, it's immoral. As regards to whether it was beneficial to the countries themselves, in some cases, you could argue that there were particular advancements. Again, I've got a whole video on this about the British rule over India and how the British did help the Indians sort of advance in terms of technology and railways and so on. But this is a tough thing, you know. If you've ever known someone who has gained or inherited a lot of money that they obviously haven't earned, and see how it affects their life, it's almost always catastrophic, certainly negative. They become paranoid, lazy, dissociated from reality. You know, we need a hard grind to survive as human beings. We got to the top of the food chain, we became the apex predators of the natural world and of each other because we embraced and loved a hard grind. The sword needs the whetstone. The muscle needs the resistance. The mind needs the problems, the challenges. People say life is hard. Good! It should be. That's the only way we ascend, is through resistance, through problems, through challenges. And people say, okay, I understand that. You want your break. You want your rest from challenges. I understand that. We all do. There's nothing wrong with that. But we need opposition, challenge, problems. Your brain is a giant problem-solving machine. It's so obsessed with solving problems that when you fall asleep and it has no problems to solve, it invents dreams where you get chased, or there are problems, or there are negatives, or there are challenges to overcome. Your brain is a constant whacka, 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 Pac-Man problem-eating machine. You feed it problems, or it makes problems up. Oh! I know, I understand, you know, for every hard workout, you need some rest time. I get all of that. But people get obsessed with this rest time. Like, oh my God, another problem. Hello, that's called life. Life is a series of problems. You either go out and embrace the problems and have real challenges, or you have the problem of feeling bored, restless, meaningless, uninspired, and full of regret for all the time you wasted by avoiding problems. You either have real problems that are useful and helpful to you, the world, and society, or you have fake problems where you just make yourself neurotic and crazy because you're not doing anything of any value or any worth. You either ask the girl out, which is scary, or you don't ask the girl out, in which case you feel the pain of regret and loss. Oh, some other guy asked her out. Oh, I should have. Ah, I'm such an idiot. So when people get something for nothing, right? I guess, what, porn makes you feel like some sort of sexual god, or video games make you feel like you're achieving something, or you take pride in what other people have done, and so on. I mean, it's terrible. I had a guy I knew who inherited a lot of money from some distant great aunt. He was like the last relative. He didn't even know this woman. He inherited a bunch of money. Messed him up completely. He didn't know whether to go to work, whether to quit. If he quit work, he was bored. I mean, it's the Notch problem. The guy who created Minecraft got like crazy amounts, like $1 billion or whatever it is. And he's bored as hell. Because everyone else is working and they have, and so you say, oh, money's going to eliminate all these problems from my life. Or, oh boy, if I get jacked, I won't have any trouble meeting girls and I won't have any problems. Or I get this promotion or I get this girl to go out with all my problems. I need to put my problems in the rear view. I'll tell you this, man. The only time your problems are in the rear view is when you're staring at a big crowd of people because the portrait has been put next to your coffin because it's your funeral. That's the only time you'll be looking back at having no problems. And then you'll say, gee, I wish I had problems again because now I'm dead. I mean, if you could think, right, you'd say, oh, what I wouldn't give for problems. And of course, every problem seems like a big deal at the time. And then if you're living life well, then you wish you had yesterday's problems, because now you've got bigger problems. The whole point of life is to chew off bigger problems until life wipes you out with the biggest problem of all, also the solution to all problems, called being dead. Stop avoiding problems. Embrace them. They're either real problems or they're made-up problems. You either have the problem of challenge or you have the problem of regret. You either have the problem of love or you have the problem of isolation. You either have the problem of ambition or you have the problem of meaninglessness. You either have the problem of fighting evil or you have the regret, fear, and terror of letting evil wash over you and win and conquer and not being able to look at yourself in the mirror because you did nothing to fight growing evil. So I just wanted to sort of point that out. The reason I'm bringing this up in the context of imperialism is in the West, through a very powerful combination of the theory of Greek philosophy, the practicality of Roman law and politics, and the universalism of Christianity, we in the West did some absolutely incredible stuff when it came to building a world of no slavery, rights for women, private property, small government, rule of law, and so on. And we went through this whole process for a couple of hundred years of reproductively disabling through death, imprisonment, or sending overseas the most violent 1 or 2% of our population, like the true psychos, right? We voluntarily disarmed ourselves in a violent world, which was fine as long as we were relatively isolated from that violent world. So we got rid of the most violent people, and therefore we ended up with a relatively peaceful society, and we let just a few more of our intelligent nonconformists live. Just a few more. We didn't just immediately kill them off and immediately string them up for blasphemy or going against the tribe or something like that. So we developed some actual valid, genuine, universal philosophical, legal, and moral principles. And so we got the good stuff, right? Being a good person is very challenging, and that's great. Because, again, you either have real challenges or your brain will make them up for you. I mean, people who should take on big challenges, if they don't, they just become neurotics, hypochondriacs, and make up invisible conspiracy theories that consume their lives to no purpose. So it's real problems or fake problems. That's all you're going to get in life. There are no such thing as no problems except at your funeral. So, in the West, we let a few more of our smarter people live and challenge the system, and therefore we got better systems over time. Socrates and Jesus, I mean, they were killed, and Galileo was tortured, but in general, we at least let the fruits of their labor spread throughout society. We're a little bit more tolerant. It's kind of a white male phenomenon. White males are the only demographic group fundamentally invested in free speech, because free speech is how society improves. Shooting the messages, being offended at negative speech. I mean, it's a bit more female than male. Men fight with fists and guns. Women fight with words and reputational destruction. So men want to ban violence. Women want to ban speech, because that's how each sex fights in general. But in the West, we got good stuff as the result of philosophical examination and extension and accepting the challenges of dissidents, and therefore we got a lot of good stuff. You had the technology takeoff, 18th century agriculture, 19th century manufacturing, and 20th century technology. We got that takeoff. And then we took all the fruits of that takeoff and spread it around the world. And that is to give people an inheritance that they have not earned. Have not earned. The other societies and cultures didn't get all the fruits of Western technology because they allowed for their dissidents to be able to survive and able to speak. And even if you killed them, you didn't burn all of their papers and destroy, like in ancient China, or not that ancient China, the guy who first came up with a really good sailing vessel, he was killed, his family was killed, all of his friends were killed, his business associates were killed, and his blueprints were all burned to the ground. And right, so there was nothing left, right? So they didn't get to sail. They got to be sailed upon by the British. And then you had the Opium Wars and so on, right? So giving people the fruits of challenges without requiring them to go through those challenges is a desperately bad idea. And that's what colonialism did. It was not good for the nations who were colonized. It was not good for the European nations. It was a great and terrible evil as a whole. What do you think can be done, next question, in order to stop the march towards a world with 100% surveilled internet and computer use? Well, the weapon that the vast majority of people, and really the only weapon that the vast majority of people have in their arsenal, is ostracism. Bam, bam, bam! That's, sorry if you were sleeping. That's the weapon that most people have. I've counseled ostracism as the foundational mechanism of social control for decades, and in order to prove the power of ostracism, I myself was willing to become ostracized, right? So I have not been thrown in jail for things that I've said, because things that I've said are true, and I have been willing to be ostracized to show the power of ostracism. It actually works really, really well. So ostracism is how you maintain social control. There are people, I guarantee this, if you're like 99.99% of people, there are people in your life who believe things that are evil or would result in evil things. You know, socialists, communists, people who are fine with central banking, people who applaud all kinds of unjust and horrible uses of political power. I mean, not that there's any just uses of political power, but, you know, in the normie sense, right? So there are people who are like, hey, you know what's great? Mandami in New York just froze the rents for everyone so that landlords can't increase rents. and be, yay, that's so cool. Yeah, well, I mean, that's just a violation of private property. It's just a violation. But the problem is, it's the problem with democracy is that the poor people outnumber the rich people, so the poor people vote to take away all the property of the rich people, and everyone then becomes poor. The renters outnumber the landlords. So the renters get to screw the landlords, and then the landlords don't want to be involved in being landlords anymore. So no new buildings get built, buildings don't get maintained anymore, and then everyone says, oh, no, these unintended second and third effects are just terrible. It's the fault of the landlords. Which is like, it's like enslaving a guy and then saying that the problem is he seems quite lazy and unmotivated. It's like, well, maybe don't use force against people to get what you want, and society will be better off. So if you have people in your life who believe and advocate for terrible, horrible, awful things. Like, here's a test, right? Here's the basic test of reality processing. It's very simple to do. It doesn't take more than 10 to 20 seconds. Say, you can just go to someone who's, you know, at all, even tangentially interested in politics, and you just say the following, or just ask the following question. We have catastrophic debt as a nation. What should we cut to balance the budget? What should we cut to pay off the debt? Because it's unfair for children to be born into, in America, $1.75 million in debt and unfunded liabilities. So just go to someone and say, we're catastrophically in debt as a nation. It's true of every Western nation. We're catastrophically in debt as a nation. What should we cut to pay off the debt? Now, people on the right will say often social programs. People on the left will often say defense and say, okay, how much should we cut? And what should be done? This is just to check whether anybody has even the slightest shred of reality processing at all. Catastrophically in debt, and you have to include unfunded liabilities, which are promises the government has made to people that it can't afford to pay for. We are catastrophically in debt. We have obligations that cannot be paid under the current system. What should be cut and by how much? Right? Just basic reality processing. And if people hum and haw and they can't make decisions and they won't say stuff, I don't have in my life people who advocate for terrible, evil, catastrophic things. I just don't. There are people in your life who believe and advocate for things that will cause the destruction of your entire civilization. Open borders, you know, whatever, right? So if you care about the future, then you reason with those people. And if they refuse to see reason, you ostracize them. Don't break bread with evildoers. I don't know why this is complicated or difficult or hard for people to understand. It's hard to do. I get all of that, but I don't know why. So here's the thing. You don't want to worry yourself about something you're never going to do, right? Like, if you say, oh, I really want a six-pack, I want abs, like Jason Momoa in Supergirl. Hey, man, not the abs, not the abs. So if you want abs, then do what you need to do to get abs. I don't know, a bunch of sit-ups and don't eat, whatever. I don't know, whatever people do to get abs. If you don't want to do those things, don't worry about the abs, right? Don't have ideas or goals or preferences that you're not taking any steps towards achieving, right? If you want to be a musician, a professional musician, but you're not really practicing and you're not trying to get paid gigs, then forget about it. Forget about it. Don't worry about it. So if you're worried about the future, your most powerful tool, say weapon, it's not really a weapon. I mean, if a woman doesn't want to date you, she says no to dating you. It's not a weapon, right? She's just practicing eugenics. But if you care about growing government power, then you have to talk to people and say, what in the government would you cut? And if they won't answer or don't answer, then you can reason with them, you know, a couple of conversations or whatever, try to bring some vague, gaseous puffs of rational air to their status-starved lungs. But if they continue to advocate for terrible, horrible, evil things, cut them off. Now, if you say, I don't want to cut them off, you know, they're friends, they're family, we've had a long relationship, I need a place to go at Christmas, fine. Fine. Then stop worrying about stuff. Because if you're not going to act on it, stop worrying about it. Worry should be reserved for things you're going to actually act on. If you're not going to do anything, stop thinking about it. Thinking about something and not doing anything is worse than a waste of time. Should I become a ballerina? Should I become the lead singer for an Irish folk band? I'm not going to do any of those things. Should I become an excellent flautist or harpist? I don't play the flute, I don't play the harp, and I'm not going to. Should I become fluent in Gaelic or oldie Englishy? No, I don't worry about these things. I'm not going to do them. So if you're worried about the future, cross-examine the people around you. And if you believe it's going to lead to a horrible, evil, dystopian future, and if people around you, their beliefs are going to contribute to that or cause that to come about, then ostracize them. And if you don't want to ostracize them, fine. Then stop whining about something you're never going to do anything about. Ever. Stop it. Stop, I don't want the future to be dystopian. I don't want the government to have too much power. I don't want this to... Okay, then cross-examine the people in your life. If the people in your life advocate for that kind of stuff, if they love the use of force, if they love to lick the bloody knife of political power, fuck them! And if you don't want to get rid of them, get rid of the worries, because you don't care about it that much. God. Do you expose your daughter to political commentators like Nicholas J... How do you pronounce that? Fuentes. I'm just kidding. He was on my show years ago. What do you mean, expose? I don't know. I don't expose my daughter to political commentators at all. I mean, we have interesting conversations about philosophy, politics, morals, and some seriously goofy stuff. But I don't say, ooh, you got to sit down and watch this, or you got to sit down. I mean, I just prefer to have conversations with her. You recently said you were okay with the population flattening out and worries about it were just an excuse for immigration, but then just tweeted people need to have 3 kids for civilization to continue. So which is it? Is this just to get likes from Musk? I'm not sure what you mean. So if the population flattens out, that is not an excuse for giant waves of immigration, because we have robots and AI to do labor. So we don't need that. And it's to do some seriously intellectual labor too, right? I mean, it won't be particularly long. I mean, lawyers will fight it like crazy. Of course, they want to maintain their monopoly. Understandable, amoral, perhaps evil, but understandable. But doctors, of course, they don't want you going to AI, uploading a bunch of scans and asking a bunch of questions, even though doctors, you know, man, it's just this time, you know, like they're really busy. Right. They just don't want to hear. They don't want to listen. AI is very patient, will answer questions, is in no hurry, is in no rush. Same thing with lawyers. Every time you ask a lawyer a question, they take out another bit of your kidney to answer it. And if you can just get some reasonable AI answers, lawyers aren't perfect, neither is AI, of course. But AI is cheap and patient. And so we are in an absolute state of flux as to how much labor in what areas will be needed in the future. And so a low birth rate is fine. If you look at times in the past, of course, when there was a massive loss of labor, obviously the big and horrible one that's most clear is the Black Death in Europe. We killed like a third, sometimes half of the population in places. And because so much labor was needed to till the land, to bring in the harvest and tend the livestock and so on, it was the beginning of the end of feudalism, right? End of serfdom, because you could negotiate for better wages and circumstances when labor goes down. So we are in the biggest state of flux that there has been since the 19th century when capital machinery began to replace the need for labor. And nobody knew where it was going to go. Nobody knows with robotics and AI where things are going to go in terms of the need for labor. So a falling population, it's self-correcting in general, right? So if you have a falling population and you don't have mass immigration, then it's self-correcting, because what happens with a falling population, then wages go up and housing in particular goes down, right? Because there's fewer people who need houses and there's fewer people who are working. So what happens is housing and education and other things become much cheaper, wages go up, and therefore people can afford to have more kids. And it's a self-correcting problem if you just let it play its way out, like in the same way that a recession is a self-correcting problem. So do people forget that 1920, 1921, there was a worse stock market crash than 1929, but I think it was Hoover was president at the time. He didn't really do anything. And so it self-corrected, right? But then with FDR and the 1929 crash, put in sort of 13 grinding years of expanding state power to, quote, solve the problem, culminating in World War II. So economics is self-correcting, absent external government interventions. And so a falling birth rate solves itself because, again, your dollar to cost ratio changes enormously, right? When there's a lot of people and it's tough, it's easier to make people than it is to build houses and more fun. So when there's a big population boom, housing prices go up and wages go down over time. When there's a population bust, wages go up and cost of living goes down enormously. I mean, just think of doctors have far fewer people to treat, and therefore they have to lower their prices because you can shop around, right? So it's a self-correcting problem. In the long run, people need to have kids, though. And so I'm not sure what the contradiction is there. As for civilization to continue, at some point, people are going to have more kids, right? If you have a birth rate of 1 or 1.2, whatever, then you're gone in a couple of generations. So the idea that the population falling is not a problem. A population continuing to fall is a problem. Like, here's an analogy, right? You do hard cardio, right? And your heart rate goes to 130, 140, whatever it is, 150. And then you stop doing your hard cardio and your heart rate begins to fall. That's not a problem. In fact, it's bad if you stop doing cardio and your heart rate continues to, right? I don't know what's going on then, but maybe it's an excess of cocaine. I don't know, right? So it's bad if your heart rate continues to race even after you stop exercising. So having your heart rate go down is not a problem. If your heart rate continues to go down and then stops, well, you have a very brief problem and then no problems at all because you're dead. Right, so anyway. Okay, did that. What else have we got? My manager passed away. I'm being thrust into his position and being asked to pick one of my coworkers to be my assistant. How do I choose? Well, if you are the boss, you must choose people based upon raw, brutal meritocracy. That's the only thing that will get other people's respect. If you choose someone because you like him and you enjoy each other's company and you laugh together and so on, the only way to maintain productivity in the workforce is to have a raw meritocracy, right? Which is, you know, one of the reasons why, I mean, the economy kind of died in 2007, 2008. It's just been propped up by money printing ever since. So yeah, you have to, and just recognize as well, like nobody feels ready for anything. Like nobody feels ready for anything. Everybody feels like a bit of a fraud, certainly to start with. So you're going to feel like, oh my God, I don't know how to be a manager. Read a bunch of books, watch a bunch of videos and so on. And just recognize everyone feels like a fraud when they're first doing stuff. And accept that that's just the price of growth. How can a free society deal with below average IQ people? They are incapable of higher order reasoning. Understand, I want a free society. I'm trying to figure out how to get there with the challenges I see. Well, you don't deal with people in a free society. So a free society is one where, in general, property rights, non-aggression principle is respected. A free society comes out of peaceful parenting. If you have children who are parented peacefully and not beaten and dealt with rationally and educated well, according to reason and evidence, you don't get criminals, you don't get psychopaths, you don't get sociopaths, you don't get narcissists. Like, these are all trauma responses to a brutal early abuse, right? Like, really brutal early abuse, like toddler, babyhood, gets you a psychopath. Brutal abuse when someone is a toddler gets you a narcissist. Brutal abuse older, like 3, 4, 5 and up, gets you an erotic, or any of these just broad generalizations, of course, right? But human dysfunction comes out of child abuse. Will there still be people with dysfunctions, even if they're raised peacefully and well? Sure, but much less, like crazy amounts less. So, in terms of how to deal with people, well, first of all, we recognize that since IQ is overwhelmingly genetic, like it's not 100% genetic, like height or eye color, but it's overwhelmingly like 80% plus. It's 80% by late teens. It only goes up from there. So it's overwhelmingly genetic. Now, still, 20% is a lot to work with. 15%, whatever, 20% is a lot to work with. And I'd rather be wise than intelligent. If you're intelligent without wisdom, then you can talk yourself in and out of anything. You can justify anything. You're your own worst enemy as far as being a sophist goes. So it's highly dangerous to be intelligent without being wise. It is far better to be wise and less intelligent than more intelligent and less wise. So wisdom is the, I can't do anything to change your intelligence really, but I can do something to have you use your intelligence better and to be wise. You know, if your truck is stuck in mud, you can't just get it out by revving the engine, but wisdom says, you know, put some chains or cables or wood or something under the wheel so that then you can get out, right? So the revving your engine faster when you're going around in circles doesn't get you going anywhere faster. So wisdom is the more practical solution to these kinds of things. So we recognize, of course, that people who are less intelligent, it's not their fault. They're not at fault for it. They're not bad people because of it. Although there is a sweet spot to criminality around the IQ 85, which is unfortunate for a wide variety of reasons, of course. But, you know, we have sympathy, we have patience, and we don't get mad at people for being less intelligent. It's not their fault. And we don't view people as better because they're smarter, because they didn't earn it. I'm not a better person because I'm smarter than your average bear. I'm more responsible for using my intelligence to better the world and so on. So I'm not sure what you mean when you say, how do we deal with them? I mean, there are less intelligent people in a society. A truly free society will have virtually infinite resources to deal with things. So, I mean, here's a tiny example, right? So if the Federal Registry in the United States, sort of regulations and so on, if they'd stayed at post-Second World War levels and wasn't unregulated, then the economy would have grown 1 to 2% greater every year. And what that means by now is people would have incomes, average income would be like $300,000 or more. Average income. Now, if people are making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, and of course they understand because they're educated about it, that smart people, it's just, I don't want to say it's fortunate or unfortunate, because sometimes you need the bluntness of less intelligent people, and sometimes you need the common sense of less intelligent people. I mean, I remember when I worked in manual labor for some time, and I would bring my sort of windy, airy, esoteric theories to the lunchroom, and people would just laugh at me like that. Huh? Kid, that doesn't make any sense. Let me tell you why, right? Blah, 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 right? And so sometimes the common sense of more, of lower IQ, more practical people is the seasoning that is needed to keep an intellectual grounded and so on. So they also have their part to play in the human story, and they have their value to bring. And they do enjoy some of the, quote, simpler pleasures, which is actually really, really important to enjoy. So, they can be enormously helpful in society. So, if somebody's too unintelligent to succeed in a free society, I mean, people who have $500,000 a year in income, and recognize it's not that person's fault, there'd be charity set up. There would be ways to make those people's lives, you know, pleasant and productive and happy and so on. And so, I mean, people are nice. They generally care. freedomain.com/donate to help out the show. So, I mean, there's not something to be done with. We would recognize that people are generally kind, especially if they're raised peacefully and well. They're generally kind and generous, understanding and helpful. They have sympathy, particularly for things that aren't people's fault, like low intelligence, and find a way to make those people's lives positive and beneficial and useful and so on, because everyone deserves, you know, at least the opportunity for purpose in this life and in this world. So I hope this helps. Thank you for the questions. I've got more. I will definitely keep the answers coming. I love you guys for the questions. Really, really hope that what I provide is helpful. If you do find it helpful, and remember, this is all ad-free. Like, I don't read ads. I don't have ads interrupting. And so if you could help out the show, I would really, really appreciate it. That's freedomain.com/donate. Lots of love, my friends. Talk soon. Bye.